Welcome to Film Forum's podcast. The following event was recorded on June 6th, live at our theaters located at 209 West Houston Street in Manhattan.
Please welcome the directors, Linda Atkinson and Nick Doob. Linda, you sit number two. Yep. Nick Doob. And now, the legendary Carmen de Lavallad. Remember the ad campaign, What Becomes a Legend Most? You just saw it. Except you didn't need fur.
Oh, thank you.
Carmen, you just watched this again.
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
What was the last? Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of going back in time, though, and seeing all my friends who are not here, you know, and that's very touching to me, aside from Jeff. You know, I'm still hanging in there, but Gus is still here, so. No, but they were wonderful times, I must say. I didn't realize how many things you do until you see something like this. You forget, you know? But they were wonderful experiences.
But aren't you doing a one-woman show about your career?
Yes, it's called As I Remember It. And that's the way I remember. I did that on purpose because, you know, everybody remembers things differently and they'll say, no, it wasn't. It was this. And it was the way I remember it. So I had no arguments. It's from my point of view. And it starts out as a child in L.A. and all my L.A. experiences and my New York experiences and my New Haven experience.
And other places at Paris and...
Well, yes, but in that evening I mentioned, I would be there for hours mentioning everything I'd done.
Well, you have to have a part two.
Yeah, so I had to pick and choose. I left a lot of things out that I really loved, but that'll have to be in a book or something, you know. And because it just, Talvin Wilkes, when I sat down to write the evening, there were so many things. It went up from 1949 or 48 all the way through, you know, to now. And I'd say, I didn't do all that. I couldn't have done all that. But it was wonderful little things, but important things. You know, the Boston Pops Orchestra, you know, dancing with the Boston Pops, dancing at the Met, dancing in little tiny out-of-the-way places, but important places, and working with all kinds of people and legendary people like Josephine, and working with Duke Ellington. And I got into the jazz people too. Benny Goodman. I actually was part of his band at one time, and I sat next to Hank Jones, and I did all the dancing, and then I sang Am I Blue? I couldn't believe it. And
I didn't know. Nick, you couldn't find a clip of this?
No, it was at Carnegie Hall. I remember it. I thought,
we
what am
see
I
that.
Doing here?
Did
I couldn't
hear
believe
about
I did that. Talk about nerve. But Benny Goodman didn't give me the old heave-ho, so I guess I was all right.
But he was legendarily cheap, I hear. Anyway.
Yeah. But it was really rather nice, you know. And the guys were so nice about it. I said, can I sit here? And they said, fine. And I sat next to Hank Jones. I said, may I? He said, fine. We had a grand time.
It's a
great
place to be next to Hank Jones.
Yeah.
Linda, Nick, how did you come to make this film? Wow. Who approached who?
This was one of my better ideas.
Hold up your mic. Hold up your mic.
This was one of my better ideas. There was Carmen was my teacher at the Yale School of Drama.
One of my Yale
babies. Let me right now say, this is only one of Carmen's careers. Carmen has an entirely other career as an actress. And she's just won an Obie for her lifetime achievement.
Right, I wanted to say that.
Theater.
Congratulations.
Yes.
So we just captured one career.
That was 2 weeks ago, by the way.
Yes.
Great PR for this evening. Thank you.
But there was an article in the Times about how many dancers had become choreographers. And I said to Nick, I said, somebody's got to make a movie about Carmen and Jeffrey. And so I went and asked Carmen, and Carmen said, ask Jeffrey. And so Jeffrey gave us his okay. And so we began, and we were so lucky because they were just starting to work on the song piece.
Yes.
They were just the songs, in the coldest winter that ever was. That's what was
How
happening.
Long did this take to make, by the way?
Ooh. It was 5 years, I think.
Long
time. Yeah, we started in 2000.
Yeah. Wow. What was so lovely is we never knew you were there.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask.
That's what I think is so wonderful about Nick and Lindy. I never knew they were there, you know. So you got all this lovely little... They became invisible, which is, I think, really remarkable in someone making a film.
Well, Nick's background is what we call a cinema verite.
He's
filmmaker.
Well,
works
he's a master.
With D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hedges. He has made films, cinema verite portraits of Al Franken, Carol Burnett, Elaine Stritch, and David Bowie. He's been a director, editor, cameraman. But how do you follow Jeffrey Holder with a camera inconspicuously? That's what I want to know.
Well, I mean, it's not a... Jeffrey knew how to handle us, I think. It's the way... and, you know, they would invite us in, and we had a lot of visits, over the 5 years, we had, you know, one visit after another, and it's all sort of very condensed here, but the thing that was hard on this film was not Jeffrey, but was figuring out what to do with all the richness of this material. It was, you know, and as Linda just said, I mean, there's a whole side of Carmen that's not in, that's... And there's, you know, we didn't want to make a film that, and then they did this, and then they did this, and then they did this. We wanted something that had a kind of a core emotional feeling to it. And I think that's what was, that was the thing that really took some time to
It's really
work
a portrait
out.
Of a marriage.
Yeah, I think
And
that's
the two of you are married, right? I mean, Some Last days. You checked. So that helped. Jeffrey passed away 2 years ago. He was 84. 14. When did he...
85, actually.
He was 85. When did he first fall into... when did his health start to fail?
Actually, I was performing at the... St. Mark's Church with Paradigm, actually, when that happened. And, but you know, I mean, he wanted to do what he wanted to do and how he wanted to do it. And there was, and you know, you couldn't change his mind. And so, you know, and he knew what he was doing. He was a trooper. He really was. He didn't complain or anything like that. He went with his artwork.
He kept creating.
To the end. He couldn't help him. When he didn't have his paint, he tore open cardboard boxes. He got all little stickies. He did all kinds of things. He made these wire. Anything he could get his hands on. We have this extraordinary poor Leo and myself. We decided that when he was in the hospital and at the end we had to bring all the paintings back. They're not paintings, they're collages and things. We counted over 400 pieces. He just couldn't stop, and they're absolutely remarkable. And he always say, I have so many things in my head, I have so many things in my head. His brain never stopped.
I remember being at your loft in Soho a couple of times. It was like the last scene of Citizen Kane.
You're right.
It was filled with Jeffrey's artwork. You needed a road map to get to find your way around.
Slide through this way and slide and walk over this, you know.
But your area was very neat.
Yes, I was a little more orderly.
Carmen, did you were in movies early on in your career. How did you break into movies?
Well, you know, everybody says movies. I mean, in those days, you got a little one-liner, you know. Gladiators. I was Susan Hayward's handmaiden. I thought it was really kind of nice. You did one little line. You know, that's all you got in those days.
You
did your
little
one
bigger
thing.
Part with Robert
well,
Wise.
Well, with Harry, I did.
And
I
Harry,
did.
Yeah.
Odds Against Tomorrow, that was a nice little role. That was really lovely. But, you know, that's as far as you can go at that time. There were no roles.
Well, Dorothy Dandridge was making it big at
Dorothy
that time.
Was just... Barely. I mean, she was really a wonderful actress.
Yeah.
She really was. And it's so sad that she passed away because she was really doing some awfully good work.
Yeah.
And Harry and all of them, but there was... How often did that happen?
Only room for a few.
Very, very few. Cicely Tyson made it through, you know. But it was... There wasn't much there, really. And you did it for a job and to get, you know... I met nice people. I think that Susan Hayward, I must admit, was such a lady. And I played the handmaiden, of course, and I never forget that it was on the back lot at 20th Century. That's when they had all the little scenes and things that the gladiators were out. And I was tromping back in the dust on a hot day, and this car rose up, and it's Susan Hayward. And she said, "Get in." And she drove me back to the dressing room. She didn't say very much. I just remember that red hair. And it was so gracious of her to pick up her handmaiden.
Well, she was.
And I felt that was a real, that's where you learn, that's a real star. That's like Josephine Baker, a real star. Those ladies knew themselves. She was not an uppity actress. I never forgot it.
Well, Susan Hayward was from Brooklyn originally. We know.
Really?
Yeah. Well, anyway, we've put together a montage of your early Hollywood bits.
Oh, dear.
And I'd like you to take a look from the front row, perhaps.
Did you get Abbott and
Costello? We'll see. It may surprise this audience that one of your first films was in an Abbott and Costello comedy. So you're one of the few people can really say you went from the ridiculous to the sublime. Let's take a look.
Oh, I can't believe this.
Roll it, Raymond.
What I meant.
was that your first dramatic part, though, in Odds Against Tomorrow?
Yeah.
And how'd that
We're
come
filmed.
About?
I don't remember. I think I auditioned for it or something. I was supposed to do the wife's part, and then they gave me this part. Her name was Kitty.
The wife was played by...
Oh, does
forgot,
anybody
I'm
remember?
Sorry.
Kim Hamilton.
It was Glory Graham was in that, too, yeah?
Oh, a lot of people were in that. Yeah. It was really a wonderful film.
Actually, that was... A little better than a bit. It wasn't a huge part, but it was a standout part.
It was
part.
A nice part. Yeah,
it was good.
It was very nice.
And the director was Robert Wise.
Robert Wise.
Terrific director.
Yes. Yeah, that was a lovely time. That was a movie that caused quite a bit of stir because then we had the Modern Jazz Quartet music.
And a terrific jazz score.
Wonderful jazz score. The story was very daring at that time.
Yeah.
And... So I was pleased to be a part of that.
Yeah, we've shown it here quite a few times. Let's take some questions from the audience. Wait for the mic. Second row, center.
Carmen, I've waited a long time for this moment because I met you in 2000 when I was 16 and full of braces and acne. And... my mother was she dated Michael Milius for 2 years.
Oh, Michael Milius, oh my goodness.
And we had a wonderful dinner with him one night, and then he took us home to meet you. And you were working on Psalms. So this was wonderful to see the results of what you were working on at that time. But I just want you to know that he said something to Michael at the time when I really, you know, I was in a high school where probably five people, I could count on one hand the number of people that would talk to me because I was so shy. And he said to Michael, he said, "That girl's a star." You know, and I'm doing a terrible Jeffrey impression, but it's something I never forgot, and I'll always remember that. And I really am so honored. I actually got to see him also about 3 years ago with Michael when you were in Chicago working on your retrospective.
Yes.
And I can't tell you how beautiful it is to feel through this film that I'm almost spending another afternoon with him, and to get more of you, because I think it was very clear to me when I met him, when he would say your name, the awe, the worship, the absolute adoration.
You see that in the film
you,
also.
Is so clear, and he's somebody that's touched my life for the rest of it, and I just wanted you to know that.
Oh, I'm glad.
I'll never forget that.
He was wonderful like that.
Happy to celebrate him tonight, and you, and what a great partnership you had.
Thank you. Thank you.
You will always have.
Thank you, darling. That was lovely. Thank you.
Thank you. And I want you to know that we all grew up doing very bad Jeffrey Holder impressions from the TV commercials.
He was wonderful with young people.
Yeah.
I tell you.
Very good.
Thank you.
He was great. Another question?
Anyone else? Everybody's quiet out there.
Oh,
where are you?
I'm back here.
Oh.
You're in the middle somewhere.
In 1954, I was a college freshman attending House of Flowers in Philadelphia. And Pearl Bailey was saying that she had driven out Peter Brook and George Balanchine that day or that week. Could you tell us about that put?
I think Jeffrey told me that Peter Brook, what was that? He said something about, he made the remark about you people. And and that's when he got the heave-ho. And she bounced him. It was something he was very disrespectful. And he got very English uppity. And said something, and she just wouldn't have it, and out it went. And that's when Herbert Ross came in, and that was because Herbert Ross choreographed Carmen Jones, and she liked Herbie and brought him in. It was one of those crazy things. And Herbie asked Alvin and myself to come. That's how we got here.
Leo says something in the doc about Jeffrey getting credit for Balanchine's? That doesn't make sense. It should be the other way around.
Leo
is actually there. We were going to save you for the end, Leo.
No, that's fine. Basically, there's a cut in the line as he was talking. What had happened was Balanchine had gotten the can along with Peter Brook. Part of the problem is that because it's not of his culture, he was having some difficulty in trying to figure out what exactly to do. Jeffrey had already had the ballet in his repertoire with Baron Samedi, so they basically, his part of the ballet was his own choreography. And that's how he got the credit for that. So there's kind of like a misunderstanding in the film, but basically that's what happened, is they incorporated Jeffrey's piece into the show that he had already had in his repertoire. Okay. That's how that worked out.
We may have to re-edit that bit.
Mr. Balanchine was very sweet about it. I mean, he because it's a whole change of the choreographer goes out with the director. Balanchine had no problem with it.
But you did work with Balanchine.
No, I didn't work.
Oh, you didn't.
I came late. This is when the big changeover came. Alvin and I came with Herbie, actually. And I know Jeffrey has a very rather fun story. He says, Mr. Balanchine, he's choreographing, of course, House of Flowers, and he was working on the steps, and he'd think about it, and he'd work on the steps, and the dancers would wait and wait. And he realized he was trying to break down a mambo. And Jeffrey said, well, all he had to do was say, mambo, and everybody would... funny.
The documentary includes an extraordinary clip from a Porgy and Bess ballet made for television in 1960. It was filmed in December 1960, but you actually filmed it twice. Do you remember what happened?
Yes. It was a cold day, and everything was out on location, as you see, which is very unusual for a dance.
Especially television videotape in those days, almost unheard of.
Yeah. And we were out in the, it was wintertime, but they were little, what do you call it?
They were the marshes, I think.
Yeah, it was in the...
Near Idlewild.
Yeah, they were their little bungalows or something. We were doing like the town part. And we had snow. Or something like that. And I know what it was. We did it, and then they lost the tape. They erased the tape.
A CBS technician erased the tape.
It was very common. That happened to me a couple of times. During that time, it was very primitive, and they were constantly erasing something. And and so I was doing ballet ballads.
That's right.
And they had to close the show down for the weekend, and we were all flown to Key West. And we did the beginning part on the dock. The part that you saw was kept, of course. It was just the little town that they erased. And we did that for the weekend and flew back, and I continue on with...
CBS actually bought out all the seats for that performance that night just
did.
So you could fly to Key West to redo the sequence. They had lost 15,000, so another 200 wasn't going to hurt them. Anyway, I think that's one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen made for TV.
Well, actually, it was better. It was better because we were on a dock.
So you think the version we're going to see right now
is
not as good as what was erased?
It's pretty amazing. This is better than what was erased. That's what I mean.
I can't imagine this being better.
In a funny kind of way, it was a blessing because it really made the piece much, much stronger, actually.
Well, let's see an extended 5 minutes of that amazing ballet.
And you know who's in it is also, aside from, can I say, to Alvin Ailey, Harold Pearson, and
I don't think we're going to see Harold
Claude
Pearson.
Thompson.
Claude Thompson played Porgy. Amazing, because he's doing it on his knees.
That's
it's incredible. Alvin is Crown or?
Crown,
because
yeah.
At first I thought he's Sport in Life. It looked, no,
that
it's
was,
Crown.
That was Harold.
I think
Pearson.
We're going to see Claude Thompson as Porgy, Alvin Ailey as Crown, and Carmen as Bess. Let's take a look. I break down every time I see that. Can you imagine that was made for network television?
In color.
Was this it in color originally?
I like it like this.
Well, I talked to someone at the Paley Center. They do have a better copy of this.
The cut version. Yes, well, you see, as television will do, they cut it. It stopped right after the hug up at the... Not the, they didn't do the fight. That was all cut. Because of time, because I think Sinatra or somebody wanted more time. I don't know. Went to the singers.
It's like Bye Bye.
And Joe Layton stole it.
This cut of it.
Yeah, Joe Layton. Yeah. Tell him who Joe Layton was.
Joe Layton was a choreographer, and he kept the original version and then gave him the rest. You know, it was stolen.
We've got to get this restored. This is one of the most important things ever made for television in my opinion.
Yes, I think it's the most beautiful ballet I've ever seen.
I totally agree.
And we had a wonderful time because, you know, we were in the dirt. No, of course, we thought we were acting, you know. We didn't care if we were falling down or in the dirt, and the dirtier it got, the better. You know, it was wonderful because we were in a real place, you know? And it helped a great deal. The Sporting Life, that was Harold Pearson.
That was Harold Pearson, yeah. Mm-hmm. By the way, it's much better as a ballet than an opera, especially this
one. A lot of people like this. They said, gee, it's told the story.
It tells the story brilliantly, much better than the Preminger movie.
It was brilliant. His work was brilliant in it.
Joe Layton was a very innovative television director as well. He made Color Me Barbara a few years later with Barbara Streisand.
Yes, he was a wonderful director.
Yeah. Any other questions from the audience? Second row. Quick. Come down. Wait for the mic.
Hi, Carmen. I think you're absolutely lovely.
Thank you.
I came here to just soak in your wisdom of maturing so beautifully, and I saw the arc of your career in black and white, and I wanted to see it here in film, and then just to absorb you here. You're just fabulous.
Thank you.
Just wonderful.
No,
too.
I keep thinking about all the, you know, I left out, there was that whole time of my life at Spoleto.
Yeah.
When it first started in Italy with John Butler. And working with Carla Menotti and oh, goodness, the people that I met at that time.
Were you there with Sandra when she was there?
Oh, yes. She was with Jerry Robbins. They
Sandra
had the
Lee.
Ballet, what is that?
Was Ballet USA.
Ballet USA, thank you, Laura. Ballet
USA.
I was with John Butler. We were in the little Kai Melissa, the tiny little jewel box of a theater off the Duomo, John Butler's company. And, oh, my gosh, it was just extraordinary at that time. And, so there are a lot of wonderful places. I wouldn't be here all day if I were talking about the things
that
I did.
Well, I just wanted to ask very quickly.
Yes.
You mentioned in the film that Alvin Ailey danced a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember there was also besides Alvin, one of my favorite dancers is Gene Kelly. And I remember one of his key dancers, I think she was in Singing in the Rain, but one of the sequences that were separate and off. But yeah, I think so.
Situation.
Yeah. But if it was or was not her, I remember her saying that her husband could always tell who she'd been dancing with because of the way her body looked afterwards, because Jean had such a firm hold and a way of handling
Alan was a great part. I had great partners. All my partners were wonderful.
Well, what did you mean by he danced a certain way, that his body moved a certain way.
He didn't
way.
Look like the dancers you would see. Do you see any dancers that look like Alvin?
No.
I have. He was so grounded. He didn't pretend. Alvin didn't take ballet lessons. That was just Alvin.
Yeah.
Alvin was moving like Alvin moved. And I like the awkwardness of it. I love it because it's real and it's strong. And then he became a character. It wasn't like he was there. And when I danced with him and waded in the water, I loved working with him in that. But when we danced together, it was like we were one person.
Yes, I can see that.
Well, I do that with my partner some kind of way, we kind of bond in a funny kind of way. As you saw in Paradigm, it was like one person, you know.
Absolutely.
But that's the way we worked at that time.
Wow.
It's not the way it is now. Everybody's in love with their bodies.
Okay.
As you notice, I didn't have those big extensions. I just didn't have that. I worked with what I had.
Right.
You know, and I think it was an advantage because you were not conscious of legs going up here and legs going up here. If I see one more leg up here, I'm going to die. You know, because your eyes are up there at the foot, you know, and you never see the... You start they start the leg and it's nice, and all of a sudden your eye go up and you're watching the leg up there and you miss the whole action. But that's the way we worked in those days.
Yeah.
That is how we, I think that's why in a funny kind of way, we didn't have the technique like they have now. No. But I think we were more alive as performers.
Was there anything special about the way that you guys interacted, whether it was private or in the creative space, that created such the bond that made that oneness that you see?
No, it's about the work. You know,
it's
about what you're trying to say. It's not about steps.
Okay.
It was never about steps. It was about content.
Okay. Thank you.
I wanted to thank the filmmakers for putting complete ballet.
Yeah, wait for the mic, please.
The filmmakers to thank you for including full dance instead of cutting up and clipping
Good
the
point.
Dances.
Good
they
point.
They really come
That's so
very cool. loud and clear. It's very hard to do in the edit to make that transfer. And thank you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. There were sections, you know, that when we were doing the Ailey piece with the Sweet Bitter Love, which I looked at, that was so beautiful.
Oh, God, that was amazing.
Because that was Bahia and Clifton?
Yes.
Yes, oh, my goodness. And it was so touching. I think because when I worked with the dancers, I said, no dancing allowed. I really did. I said, no dancing allowed. It's about the story. You have the technique. I don't care about it. It'll take care of itself. And there were times when they would break out in tears because they got involved in the story. And I said, I don't want to see any whiny ladies, no tough guy beating on a lady. These are two people who are really lovely people but have to break up. And that's when everybody got very emotional. And I said, I like it when the guys cry. And they got very upset. And there were times when they had to leave the room. It was really lovely because they got involved in the characters for the first time. They didn't ask for steps. It was a play. It was a play, and that's what, and it was very exciting to work like that because not many do work that way. But that's the what we did at that time at Lester Horton's Dance Theater. That's what we did. They were plays, and Lester called them choreo dramas. We were doing plays, Salome and Yerma. It was about people and characters. The technique served the story. It wasn't the other way around. I'm finding all you see. It's almost like acrobatics now. There's nothing here anymore, and to get that out of you, have to break that. I said, stop dancing, and then it gets exciting when all of a sudden the light goes off, and they finally looked at each other in the eye for the first time, you know, and then it really gets interesting how their dancing changes, the young people. I love doing that kind of work. That's what I'm doing now. Whenever I see a dancer just doing leg work, that's when I really get at them. And they change, too. They really like when they discover that they don't need that, that'll serve itself. You know, that's what it's there for. It's a good tool. But does it tell the story? It's about the work. That's all I have to say.
I wanted to ask Linda, Nick, how much input did Carmen and Jeffrey have in the content of the film, if any? What was to be included? You just talked about all the things that were not included in the documentary. And we have some of that tonight.
Well, they had, and Leo, I mean, as the curator, they have a wonderful archive. As you can see, they've saved so much stuff that's invaluable. And I have to say that it was Nick's editing really is remarkable in this film.
Absolutely.
Because it doesn't go he did, she did. It doesn't go like that at all.
Leo remembers everything. I depend on him. I really do, more and more now. But Leo remembers things that I don't remember, and it's of course he was there all the time.
And there were some discoveries while we were making the. Yeah, while we were making the film that you brought in. A lot of things, in fact. The Wiz footage.
Oh, yes, that was wonderful. Ray
Bolger
that was? Oh,
on stage with... That was magical.
But to see the Wiz, you see how it's like a child's storybook, you know?
Yeah.
It was whimsical and fun and witty and the poppies, you know, with the big poppies.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just... The watermelon, it's so beautiful. Yeah, but who else would think, oh, watermelon moon, you know? I mean, it was so beautiful, but it worked. It's fantasy. It was fantasy and playful. It was playful. And that's what was, and that's Jeffrey, of course. He likes to play.
Did you purposely leave out the pop side, the pop culture side of Jeffrey, or was that a rights issue about clearing footage?
You know his. You mean the commercials?
Well, the commercials. You know,
in the movies. You mean,
yeah.
We had the movies, but we didn't really have anything around them. I mean, we couldn't kind of get inside them.
I see. Well, a lot of us grew up knowing Jeffrey solely as a pop culture icon. We didn't know he was this Renaissance man. We knew him as the guy who did the 7-Up commercials. Oh. So we put together a little montage of Jeffrey as a pop culture icon. Sorry, we serve Sprite here. Come on up. You know, in the documentary, you see Bert Lahr's son, the New Yorker critic John Lahr, interviewing Jeffrey. And John Lahr once said of his father, who was in vaudeville, movies, theater, that his greatest fame came from a potato chip commercial. Can you say the same for Jeffrey? He became a household name as Jan Coleman. And we grew
That's
up
true.
Imitating him, bad imitations. But he did that for how many years?
Oh, my goodness. Leo, do you know how long?
That one that we just showed was from 1969,
1970. That the first one?
Yes, and it was revived in the early 80s.
So I'd like to thank YouTube for that clip, by the way.
There's a series of them from the early 80s, and that's when...
The revived, yeah.
Yes.
So he did them over a course of 12 years. Something like that. Or he revived them.
Often on, yes.
But it must have paid for a lot of oil paints.
Yeah. It paid
very helpful.
It paid for a lot of it. I must say something about the one that I showed you. I actually have somewhere in the bowels of my files the actual storyboards for this particular commercial. And it was not designed for him. It was actually designed for a plantation owner with a big twirly mustache. And somehow, I believe through the actress Paula Lawrence, he got the call to try out for it. And
Leo, why don't you come up front and so that people could see you in the voice in the dark. Leo, your greatest creation, Carmen. Leo Holder.
I like keeping a low profile, but this... the actual story, and I was there for the shooting of that commercial.
Which one? The first one?
Yes.
You were little.
The first Colonet commercial, I was there. And I still have the storyboards, and yes, it's for a little guy in a white hat with a twirly handlebar mustache.
Kind of a Colonel Sanders.
It was kind of a plantation owner kind of thing.
That imagery would really go down well today. Yes.
But needless to say, as Jeffrey Holder does, Jeffrey Holder takes over. So he started bringing in his own thing. The Marvelous, that was him. That was not scripted. There were a lot of things that were not scripted that just...
By the way, I noticed he used a 7-Up can in one of his Whiz costumes.
Yes,
he knew where his bread was buttered, I guess.
The Tin Man, that was his little signature.
That's fantastic. Yes. And he also played, of course, Baron Samedi in Live and Let Die,
yes,
which was the same character he played in House of Flowers, right?
Yes,
Haitian folklore.
Yes. In fact, the clip you saw there was probably the worst day of his life.
Well, I remember he gave me a copy of his book,
yes.
And we saw a picture of Robert Shaw, and he said, "Asshole."
Oh,
was that the problem?
No. Rex Harrison.
Rex Harrison.
It's Rex Harrison who's the asshole.
Oh, see, I'm...
No.
maybe they were all assholes.
That was Doolittle. That was... That,
really?
That unto itself is a chapter which... there was a book that came out a few years ago on the films of 1968 that actually, like, when the studio system actually made its turn. They included Bonnie and Clyde, they included Doolittle, they included both successes and flops to talk about the changeover in the Hollywood system.
But Doolittle almost sank the studio.
Doolittle almost sank the studio.
Yeah. Not because of Jeffrey. He was the best thing in it.
But getting back to Live and Let Die, that little clip that you saw with the snakes was the worst day of his life because he had a deadly phobia. Snakes.
Really bad.
Originally told that a stunt person would be doing that, which is probably why he agreed to take the role. And came the day, not only did he not have a stunt person, but there was royalty on the set. And he had to dive in, and you have to understand, Jeffrey was 6'6", And tall people have very bad knee problems by default, especially if you're a dancer. And somehow this very tall man had to dive in headfirst into the narrow end of this coffin filled with rubber snakes, which he has a total, literally,
terror.
You could not draw a snake in front of him. It was that bad. So the screams you hear in that movie are actually Jeffrey Holder in the worst day of his life. No joke.
No, he was miserable.
Trooper. Yeah. Trooper.
But he kept getting those parts. He was popular. Did he enjoy doing those roles?
For the most part.
He played exotic characters, always.
For the most part, and let's face it, it paid the rent.
It did pay the rent.
I think my favorite really is him reading the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
He did a beautiful job in that. Yes. Just lovely.
I spoke to you before the filming start. I've been trying to hunt down, and you gave me a tip. I'm sorry. I've been looking for this for a very long time, and you gave me the tip earlier.
We will find
it. Possibly find it. He actually had a song in Dr. Doolittle that was cut, and appropriately enough, and this is the mystical part of Jeffrey. It always somehow falls into place. The name of his song was "A Man Can Do Anything."
Wow.
And who more appropriate?
If they had kept it in, it might have been a hit. You never know. And Carmen, you also had a second career as an actress. You were on a couple of soap operas.
Oh, yes, Ryan's Hope or something like
that. Let me see.
That
Search for Tomorrow, you had a recurring role.
Is that? Oh,
it paid the
Ryan's
rent.
Ryan's Hope, yeah. There was another one.
You
very
were
brief.
In Big Daddy with Adam Sandler.
Yes, I was the judge.
And The Hours with Meryl Streep. But you also did some wonderful television work as a dancer.
That was John Butler. A lot of those old early morning religious programs, Lamp Unto My Feet and Look Up and Live.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I danced every biblical heroine in the book. It was wonderful. It was just wonderful.
Even Joan of Arc.
Joan of Arc, yes, I did all that. It was, and I danced with Mildred Dunnick at one time.
Mildred Dunnick?
Yes, John Butler created it. We had a ballet, and Millie was the voice. It was a Francois Villon poem about the old woman. It's a story about her growing old and being a young woman, and all, but it's beautiful. I can't think about the name right now.
A Touch of Loss,
it was called. And I danced with Mildred Dunnick. And she did the vocal part, and I did the dancing part. I was her as a young woman. And I became very good friends with Mildred, and that's how I think I got to Yale in the long run.
And you've been teaching at Yale since the early 70s.
I taught during that 70s period. That I don't know what they had in the water, but my goodness, it was an extraordinary period, the Brustein period. And it was almost like being at my Lester Horton's Dance Theater in a funny kind of way, because it was a school of doing. It wasn't, you didn't go to a classroom and learn to act and you get your little whatever it is and go out and try to find a job. You worked, right, Linda?
Yes.
We had the main stage productions. We had the student productions. We had playwright productions. We had the cabaret. We had the director's productions. And everybody worked. The teachers, all the instructors, and the young actors would be on the same stage together. It was absolutely wonderful, and it was rotating repertory. And so, we were kept busy, and it became more like a family. So that when you graduated from Yale, you were ready. You were absolutely ready, and they were. Meryl and yourself, and Gross, and Henry Winkler. I mean, they got out of there, and they were really accomplished actors by then. Because it was really hard work. You really got you did not just get a scene and then. No, you did the work.
If I may add on to that, because I have to give some credit here, which would otherwise be not acknowledged. Linda was part of the student body at that time, and one of the landmark productions they did at the time was Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yes, she was Puck.
And Linda was Puck. Linda was amazing.
It's beautiful.
No, it, it's...
production. You did? Yes, and I was Titania. Yes.
It's no mistake that this couple working with that couple were able to understand each other to do that because of the various understandings of their disciplines. Linda is stone cold pro. Nick, stone cold pro. They come from their background in their various fields, their pedigree, that's the word of the term, is second to none. And so a couple with a pedigree like that, approaching a couple with a pedigree like theirs, it was just meant to happen. It was
all four of you are extraordinary. We want to thank Nick Dube, Leo Holder, Linda Atkinson, and Carmen. And we're going to end the evening wait for it. Back. Come on. Timing is everything in show business. We're going to end with that wonderful Josephine Baker French television special with you and Jeffrey. Okay? Let's take a look from the audience. We want to thank Nick Dube, Linda Atkinson, Leo Holder, and Carmen de Lavalade. Now's the time.
Thank you for listening to Film Forum's podcast. Visit us online at filmforum.org, where you can learn more about our films, memberships, subscribe to our free weekly e-newsletter, and to find out the ways you can support our nonprofit cinema. And if you have the time, please visit our iTunes page and leave a rating and review of our podcasts. Copyright to this program belongs to The Moving Image Incorporated.